And you just heard Paul there. Sounds like a pretty decent weather week. You're listening to WICC, the Voice of Connecticut. I'm Bridget Quinn, and this is Newsline with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon when Paul Pacelli takes over. So decent weather and a good time to drive around Connecticut and check out the beautiful foliage just starting. Joining us live on Newsline is the Director of Connecticut Tourism, Rachel Lenda. Rachel, so good to have you here. Since we moved back to Connecticut, my family and I have been driving around to various points, touristy spots, and really trying to get to know the state a little bit better. What I've noticed in my travels is the foliage certainly in evidence beginning, but when is the peak?
Hi, Bridget. Good afternoon. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so glad that you moved home here to Connecticut. We needed a resident like you. I'm born and raised in Connecticut. I grew up in Eastern Connecticut. And I've been blessed with, 38 seasons, foliage seasons now. So, growing up, I went to, went to Patchogue State Forest, which is one of the largest state forests in the state of Connecticut. And that is in the Lasgrain Valley, which is a beautiful area, picturesque area of Eastern Connecticut that comprises of 26 towns. So it has a pretty big footprint. But there are plenty of places statewide where you can go to catch the hues of amber and gold and red and crimson. And it is just so picturesque. And whether you just want to take a walk down a trail or if you want to hike up a mountain, there's several places you can go. And according to DEEP, which is the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the peak fall foliage in Connecticut, it's expected to arrive this coming weekend and stay particularly through the end of October. And it is most certainly picturesque in northwest and northeast corners of the state. And a little fun fact is that the Connecticut River, which starts at the mouth of the Long Island Sound and going up to East Haddam, will hold foliage the longest. And that's often into the first weeks of November.
Okay. So
if you're looking for for actual places to go, here's where I would strap on my hiking boots or even my walking shoes. And I'm a modest climber. I'm not somebody who likes to scale mountainsides or anything.
Same. I like to hike. I like to walk. I'm not into rock climbing or anything like that. But
same.
Okay. Good. And before we strap on our sneakers, let's just say I'm taking notes, by the way, Rachel, because I'm delighted to hear that the peak is coming up this weekend into the end of the month, because we don't have any particular plans this coming weekend. So now I am going to take notes on where we should go. So go ahead. Give us some of the hot spots.
Yes. So I'm going to go from west to east in the state of Connecticut. So coming in midwestern Connecticut, almost on the border of New York, there's a beautiful little town called Kent, Connecticut, and there's Kent Falls State Park.
I've been there. I'm sorry. I have to jump in. We were there a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Gorgeous.
Beautiful, right? I mean, it's so picturesque. It's your quintessential, woodsy, foresty New England experience. And then heading a little bit heading more towards Hartford, you're going to look at Talcott Mountain State Park, and that's in Simsbury. What is so interesting about the state of Connecticut is its topography. If you're going from eastern Connecticut, which is really like more rolling hills, and then you head more into western, that's where you're getting much larger hills, certainly not, the mountains like in other states, of which we will not mention. We only need to worry about Connecticut.
Don't give them a plug.
I would never. That's why I'm not saying it. But that's where the elevation increases, and you've got some ski resorts like Mohawk Mountain and Powder Ridge, and those places are great because like Powder Ridge, right? You can take a scenic chairlift, and you get 360-degree views of all of that epic foliage. We're all along the mountain, and there's all other kinds of outdoor activities that you can do besides just walking. You know, you can mountain bike, you can take the dogs out. You know, there's so much to do. And then lastly is Sleeping Giant State Park in Haddam. And that is such a beautiful location because of its elevation. And then I'd also be remiss if I did not put in Hubbard Park, that is in Meriden. And that is also a beautiful view once you get to the top and you head up into that rock tower there and take a look at everything. I have firsthand experience with that.
You know,
it's beautiful.
This past weekend, we were up in the Clinton area getting a little shopping in.
Girl.
And on the way home, we ran out of time, but I wanted to swing by Hammonasset, which is just a great, great beach. And this time of year, beautiful, right? And you can maybe not, you know, necessarily for foliage peeping, but just a great time of year to visit that spot.
I agree. You know, I'm your typical New Englander. I live in New England for a reason. I love the four seasons. And yes, summer at the beach is amazing, but smelling the ocean in October when the days are still, you know, 70, 75 degrees and there's nobody there and you can sort of just sit in your thoughts and hear the waves and you know, not swelter. And, you know, bring your pups or your pets. And
right.
It really is a very magical experience. You know, there's nothing like being on one of the beaches along Connecticut's coastline. And, you know, we've got hundreds of miles of coastline that offers all. And plus in the fall time, too, there's always great fishing. I've personally loved to little tautog, little black fishing, you know, off the coast of Stonington area. I've done that before. That's always an adventure. So lots to do in the fall.
That sounds like fun, too. We are back on Newsline on WICC with Rachel Lenda, the director of Connecticut Tourism. It is so great to chat with you about all things Connecticut. Wonderful places to go. And just before that break, I was waxing a little bit nostalgic about trips to Essex and the steam train there and the lovely little shops. Before, Rachel, we get into some other great spots to visit in Connecticut this time of year, I have to ask you, there was an article recently about Connecticut tourism maybe not getting as much money as it needs, that you're unable to promote it quite as much as you might like. Is that true or is that not a problem?
So this is a subject that I have to dance around, and that is because, you know, my employer is the state of Connecticut, and I'm handcuffed in a way of talking about the promotion of my department getting money. However, what I can say is that compared to our neighboring states, we are the lowest tourism funded with state taxpayer funds within the New England region. But our economic output is we just got back a recent study and in tourism economics, and in 2023, our economic output for the tourism industry was $18.5 billion, which is up 8.8% from 2022, which was $17 billion. And that employs roughly 124,000 jobs. And it puts $1.2 billion into local and state taxes. So the tourism industry in the state of Connecticut is, it's alive, it is vibrant, it is, it's everywhere. And, you know, I think a big part of that is because if we're looking at who's coming into the state of Connecticut to enjoy our amenities, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that 42 to 45% of the people who visit Connecticut attractions are Connecticut residents, because the way we gauge residents coming in is within a 25-mile radius of them leaving their front door. So, yes, the short answer is that we could always use more money, and I think what's difficult right now is that, and I'm sure every business out there who has marketing and advertising dollars, is that this is an extremely competitive market for advertising right now. It's an election season. People's attentions are getting diverted left and right. And the cost of advertising right now has gone up because of the demand. So it is very tricky. Trying to find my right words here.
Rachel, I think you've explained it beautifully, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot at all. I just would have felt remiss not asking about it just because there have been headlines about it. But listen,
and I appreciate you asking about it because I do think it's important, and I think it's also important for our residents to know that the money that's being invested in marketing Connecticut as a great place to live, work, and play, we're seeing that return on that money come back within the first 12 to 18 months of somebody seeing our marketing or advertising. And that, we know that is through a wave study that we do every year on our brand and people who are exposed to the fabulous marketing that we put out there to tell us a compelling story about why Connecticut is just such an amazing place to visit, and also potentially, like you did, make it your new home.
Right. And, you know, you make a great point about people in Connecticut being tourists, if you will, in other spots in Connecticut. And, you know, it's just amazing. So when we were first here, we were in Westport, and then you drive, you know, maybe an hour, right? And it's a totally different landscape, totally different scene. And you feel like, you know, you could be anywhere. It has such diversity. Tell us a little bit about some other places that we can visit during this season when, again, the foliage is just gorgeous. I was reading the notes about some other places, including a Connecticut wine trail, which I wasn't aware of that.
Yes. So Connecticut hosts a beautiful wine trail. And that goes from, you know, you've got Aquila's Nest out in Sandy Hook. You've got, you know, saltwater vineyards out in Stonington. And you've got the Aragonese wine venue out in Middletown area. And really it just spans from, you know, border to border. And there's all sorts of different varietals and things that you can enjoy. You can enjoy VIP tasting sessions. So I always recommend going to ctvisit.com to learn more about, and you can get links to all those different websites. And the Connecticut Wine Trail is also in partnership with our fabulous people over the Department of Agriculture for the state of Connecticut, which is also a great resource on finding, you know, things to visit, to eat and drink and do. But besides the Connecticut Wine Trail, we also have, it is orchard season, right? Oh my gosh.
I was going to ask you about that when you said time to eat some good stuff. That's what came to mind. Tell us about some good orchards.
So I've got, I can't say that I have favorites because they're all my favorites, right? They're all my favorite children. But some highlights are, you know, you've got Bishop's Orchards, which is in Guilford. That's just outside of New Haven. You can pick your own pumpkins, and they've got, you know, all the corn mazes and the apple picking and the wagon rides. And so I grew up going to Holmberg Orchards out in Gales Ferry. There's Lyman Orchards out in Middlefield. You've got pretty much orchards in every neck of the woods in Connecticut. So it's, and you know what I love about orchards too, is that they, it's such a family-friendly experience.
So true.
Where they really cater to making sure that it's a memorable experience for you and your kids and your family. You know, I've got a 2.5-year-old. I love to stick her face, you know, in like the hole where she's a pumpkin and take a picture. And, you know, she's a spicy little redheaded ginger. Aww. So I love to. Aww. I know, she's my little pumpkin.
Oh, that's adorable. But, oh, my goodness.
I'm a mom, too, and I know how amazing it is to get out to those places throughout Connecticut during the fall season where moms and dads remember, if you have a Christmas card coming up, is a great time to take a picture and put that on your Christmas card.
Oh, that's right. Just make sure you all wear the same color that day, right?
Yeah.
And also family friendly fun in the form of those hay rides that some of the orchards offer. I think we used to go to Silverman's years ago, and we found an adorable little place, kind of off the beaten path, the hickories yesterday, and we got some pumpkins, and I thought it was just the cutest thing. There was just a sign. This is the honor system, you know, for paying for your pumpkins. We're like, wow, this is just too quaint. It was really, really, really a wonderful day. Hey, listen, please come back on the show, Rachel Lenda. You are fantastic, the director of Connecticut Tourism, and give me some more ideas and our listeners, and looking forward to the peak foliage, and I'll direct our listeners to ConnecticutVisit.com, yes?
CTVisit.com. You got it, Bridget.
CTVisit.com. CTVisit.com. Rachel, have a great day. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And a solemn day today in many corners of the world, because today marks 1 year since the horrific Hamas attack on Israel. And joining us live on Newsline is Yotam Confino, a CBS reporter, joining us live from Tel Aviv. Yotam, it is good to have you here on this day. Set the scene for us in Tel Aviv today.
So it actually started already at 6:30 this morning, where millions of people woke up and began the memorial service, because it was exactly a year ago that Hamas launched their attack at 6:30 in the morning. So a lot of people along the Gaza border communities gathered to commemorate this horrific day, to mourn the losses, and of course also the 101 hostages who are still held in Gaza. And Hamas decided to fire rockets at the exact hour that the memorial began, simply to remind Israelis that the war is not over and that they will continue to terrorize Israel as much as possible. And since then, it's been a long day of mourning. The Israeli army has, of course, still attacked both Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has attacked Israel back. And we also had an attack from the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So despite the whole nation mourning, holding memorial services, the war is continuing, and it's really just ramping up right now.
A short time ago, we spoke with a couple of documentarians about the Nova Music Festival attack. Their documentary really giving a timeline of what happened on that day, and a number of the hostages, as you say, still being held, were taken at that music festival. Yotam, tell us about the hostages, their families. What are they saying? What are they doing today?
They are, a lot of them are in the kibbutzim, the villages, where the hostages were taken. Many of them come from those areas. So they were spending the day with other residents. And some of them also demonstrated today. Others are gathered in Tel Aviv. There's quite a large memorial happening right now with music and speeches. And they are all calling still on the government to do everything they can to sign a deal with Hamas. But it really doesn't look like that's what's about to happen. On the contrary, the ceasefire negotiations in past months have really just stalled. No development whatsoever. So it's not looking good for them. So a year into this nightmare, they don't have any sort of really... no, I wouldn't say hope, because they do have hope, but they don't really see any end to this. They don't see a ceasefire happening where they can get their loved ones back.
Yotam, do we know why the ceasefire negotiations have stalled?
It's extremely difficult, but I'll try and simplify it. First of all, Hamas is insisting that Israel remove their forces from all of Gaza. And it's something that Israel has said they won't do, or at least Netanyahu has said that he will continue to control the corridor separating Gaza from Egypt to prevent future smuggling of weapons into Hamas. And Hamas is refusing to compromise whatsoever. They don't want to release all the hostages all at once. It has to be done in stages. So I would say both Hamas and Prime Minister Netanyahu have not really been very flexible lately. But at the end of the day, Hamas is the is the one holding the hostages, and they could end the war tomorrow if they release the hostages.
Right. We, of course, today are remembering those killed in the Hamas massacre, and also, Yotam, a day to remember the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers killed in this year-long now war.
Yeah, just today, two soldiers were killed in Lebanon, and they really are being killed almost on a daily basis. Just this week, actually, 10 soldiers were killed in Lebanon. So this is the new main arena of war. It's Lebanon. Gaza is still, of course, there's still fighting going on in Gaza, but Israel has pulled out most of its forces and relocated it to the northern border. And so they're now focusing on Hezbollah in Lebanon. And that's also one of the reasons why many of the relatives of the hostages feel like they've abandoned them inside Gaza, because there's very little focus on Gaza right now. The focus is on Hezbollah and, of course, also Iran.
Right. And last week we saw, speaking of Hezbollah, we saw an attack by Iran on Israel. And we've been waiting ever since for an Israeli response. What has Netanyahu said about that? And when might we see some sort of response?
So this is part of the game. Every time that either Israel or Iran is responding to an attack, they take their time, mainly because it's psychological warfare. The Iranians, the regime, are quite anxious right now because they don't know what's going to happen. And Israel is quite strong militarily. So they're worried about their nuclear sites, their oil facilities, their ballistic missile productions. And Israel is enjoying this. And the same, Iran did the exact same thing when they promised to retaliate. They sent all of Israel on the edge, really on high alert. But we don't know when it's going to come. But we're hearing that it's very soon. Israel seems as if they've already decided what they'll do. The big question is what they'll hit, because the United States has already said, President Biden has said, he does not support an Israeli attack on nuclear sites, and he does not support an Israeli attack on oil fields. So that's two major arenas that Israel is not getting a carte blanche from the U.S. to attack. Whether Israel will adhere to that, that remains to be seen.
Right. You really wonder what the response might be. And Yotam, it was also rather unexpected when we found out how Israel was going after some of the Hezbollah terrorists, going after their pagers and walkie-talkies. That was really just a bizarre development in this war.
Very, very bizarre, highly sophisticated, highly efficient, but also something that caused a lot of outrage, because obviously civilians were also injured and killed in these attacks, because the pagers exploded in the hands of members of Hezbollah, but people who were nearby, civilians, some of them were injured and killed. Nevertheless, Israel saw this as a highly successful attack, which took out about 1,500 members of Hezbollah. Most of them were wounded, obviously. But that was, for Israel, a significant attack that weakened Hezbollah. And also, Israel is continuing to assassinate all of their leadership. We even said that the next leader of Hezbollah, who's only been in charge for a week, but he's also been killed now. So Israel has a clear strategy. Simply destroy Hezbollah as much as possible, which includes killing everyone who's a member.
Is there any talk today, or perhaps this has been paused, of what happened on October 7th a year ago? As far as I had ever heard any comments from Benjamin Netanyahu about that, the feeling seemed to be, let's talk about that when the war is over. We're not going to talk about intel failures and such. Is there any talk about that today?
Yeah, absolutely. For a year now, obviously the public demands answers. How could the strongest military in the Middle East, possibly the fifth largest and biggest, strongest army in the world, how could they allow this to happen? A couple of things we do know. First of all, there were intel that Hamas was planning something major, but it was ignored. The intel that was provided by lower-ranking officials and sent higher up in the hierarchy, that intel was dismissed. They simply didn't believe that Hamas had the capabilities to do it, to carry it out. but they were very, very wrong. And it's kind of, it's almost a deja vu from 1973, when there was also intel that back then it was Egypt and Syria were about to attack Israel. And they were very arrogant back then. They just dismissed it as, you know, they don't have the guts to do it. They don't have the capabilities to do it. They did the same. They made the same mistake here. So intelligence was dismissed. And, of course, they didn't have enough troops down there. That's a whole other issue. But we don't have a state commission yet that can clearly state exactly what happened. It's underway. Hopefully it will happen because the public demands answers.
Right. And on this day, 1 year later, the Palestinians are giving a casualty count, if you will. I've heard differing numbers. I've heard upwards of 41,000 lives lost. Those numbers, I believe, come from the Gaza Health Ministry. What are you hearing from that side?
It's one of the most difficult parts of this entire war. It's the data coming out of Gaza, because when we say the health ministry, it does sound professional, but it's Hamas. Hamas is controlling the health ministry. And Hamas does not distinguish between civilians and combatants. In other words, they say 40,000 people have been killed, and we have no idea exactly how many civilians. That's a huge issue, because there's a difference between being a member of Hamas or being a two-year-old child. So on the Israeli side, the estimate is that roughly 20,000 members of terror groups have been killed. If that's true, that makes it that makes the combat to civilian ratio very, very low, even though it's a high number. But we don't know also, because Israel also cannot provide every name of every person that has been killed. So it's an estimate. Either way, too many civilians have been killed. I don't think anyone disagrees over that. The question is who to blame here. A lot of people would like to blame Israel because they dropped the bombs. Other people would like to blame Hamas because they hide between in civilian areas, in schools, UN facilities, and mosques.
Yotam Confino, CBS reporter in Tel Aviv. So good to have you on the air with us on this important day of remembrance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.